Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology member-led forum and your co-chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Olivia Fox Caban. Olivia Fox Caban is an expert in the fields of charisma and leadership. Olivia has lectured at Stanford, Yale, Harvard, MIT, UC Berkeley, and the United Nations. As a frequent keynote speaker and executive coach to the leadership of Fortune 500 companies, she helps people become more persuasive, influential, and inspiring. From a base of thorough behavioral science, Olivia extracts the most practical tools for businesses and organizations. Sharing her techniques she originally developed for Harvard and MIT. Olivia is also a columnist for Forbes, Fast Company, and the Huffington Post. She is often featured in media, such as the New York Times, Bloomberg, and Business Week. She has been profiled in the Wall Street Journal and NPR's Marketplace. Olivia's presentation today is based on her new book, The Charisma Myth, where she breaks charisma down into its fundamental components. Please join me in welcoming Olivia Fox Caban.
Marilyn Monroe wanted to prove a point. It was a hot summer day in 1955 in New York City. She went down into Grand Central Terminal, boarded one of their subway cars, and as she was going down the steps, as she was waiting for the train, as she was boarding the car, not a single person recognized her, even though she had both a photographer and two magazine reporters in tow. Not a head turned, even though the camera clicked the whole way through. What she wanted to prove is that she could at will decide whether to be glamorous Marilyn or plain and simple Norma Jean. On the subway, she was Norma Jean. But when she reemerged onto the busy streets of New York City, she decided to turn Marilyn. And from what the reporter said, there was no grand gesture. Nothing really changed. All she did was kind of fluff up her hair and strike a pose. But somehow, when she said, "Do you want to see her, the Marilyn?" somehow, immediately, an aura of magic seemed to ripple from her. And all of a sudden, time stood still, people stood still, as they suddenly recognized the star standing in their midst. Charisma, when I say that I teach that at cocktail parties, people's reaction is generally, "Oh, but I thought you couldn't teach that. I thought you either have it or you don't." And so when I was asked to write a book about charisma, the first myth that we wanted to kind of explode was the fact that charisma is not innate. In fact, I can sum up the book in one sentence for you. It's not innate. It can be learned. Here's how. With that, you're done. So charisma is actually a set of learned behaviors. And because it is behavior-based, it can be present one moment and gone the next. One moment you see it, the next you don't. And in fact, in control laboratory experiments, researchers were able to raise or lower people's level of charisma as if they were turning a dial just by instructing them to display specific, K charismatic behaviors. So these behaviors are usually learned early, so early in life, like many other social behaviors, that by the time people get to adulthood, which is when we usually get to know our charismatics, these behaviors seem to be innate, but they're not. My favorite analogy for charisma is that it's kind of like driving a car. Not everyone's going to become a Formula One race car driver. I will always be a terrible driver. However, I have learned enough to get me generally from point A to point B. Not everyone is going to become Bill Clinton. But most people can learn enough charisma to see a measurable difference in their daily lives. And most people, in fact, can learn enough charisma to have to handle the side effects, which we'll talk about tonight. Because I have news for you. All forms of charisma come at a cost. People don't usually talk about the underbelly of the surface glitter, but it's there. So, learned behaviors usually learn so early in life that by the time you get to adulthood, it seems to be natural, innate. For most charismatics, some, however, make a conscious decision at a certain age that they're going to learn this whole charisma thing. Steve Jobs is a great example of that. And if you look at his presentations, a good stretch to look at is from 1984 to, of course, 2011, and you see the progression, and you see him learn the various elements of charisma step by step. You see how he gains the different elements that we're going to be talking about tonight. Steve Jobs' charisma was methodically, and some say fanatically, learned and controlled. So what are these behaviors? They can be pretty much lumped into three categories: presence, power, and warmth. Presence is the fundamental of charisma. It's that ability you have to be simply fully present, mindfully aware in a conversation of what is happening moment by moment in your experience. And when you hear people talk of their experience of meeting a highly charismatic person, they'll often speak about that. They'll say, he had such a great presence. And of course, Clinton is famous for the ability to make you feel that you are the only person in the room. When you're speaking with him, there is no one but you. So that's presence. The second is power. And power is actually not the power to command an army. It's not the actual power you wield. It's more the perception we have of your ability to affect the world around you, whether this be through large amounts of money, of social status and capital, of intelligence, of raw sheer physical power, and on and on. The third element is warmth. And warmth is pretty simple. It's how much you give us the impression that you like us. One of the simple ways to look at charisma is what we're really asking when we're meeting someone new. You know the classic friend or foe question? With charisma, what we're really asking is, could you move mountains for me, power, and would you care to do so, warmth? Highly charismatic people give you the impression that they both have a lot of power and like you a lot. So, presence, power, and warmth. Good examples for presence, Clinton, of course, is a great one. Good examples for power, this is where you can go to most dictators. Hitler was a very charismatic example. And good example for warmth is, of course, one of your classic, the Dalai Lama, is a wonderful warm presence. That, by the way, is my cheat sheet for myself. There's nothing on there that you need to know for tonight. If one of you actually wants to come up and read from that, happy to turn it over. So, in the process of learning charisma, what you actually need to look at first are what are the current hindrances that are stopping, hindering, dampening your levels of either presence or power and warmth. So let's look at presence. Have you ever been in a conversation when only half your brain was present and the other half was busy thinking about something else?
Oh, once or twice.
All right. When that happened, there's a good chance that your facial expressions were a split second delayed. And when there is a delay in facial expressions, you will come across as inauthentic, that there's something off, something not quite right. The human being reads facial expressions extraordinarily quickly. We catch facial expressions as fast as 17 to 32 milliseconds, what it's called micro-expressions. We think we can fake presence. We think we can fake listening. We think that as long as we kind of look at them and kind of pretend that we're here, we're doing okay. We're wrong. So, tools, of course, to combat that. Presence is hard. Mindfulness is one of the toughest disciplines you can ever choose to practice. One of my favorite ways to stay present in a conversation is slightly quirky, but remarkably effective. If you would, right now, focus on the sensations in your toes. What that does is that it forces your brain to sweep your body from head to, of course, toe, and gets you very physically present in the moment. Obviously, you do that for a split second, then you get back to the conversation. But just for a split second, very effective. Focus on your toes. That's one technique. Another technique that's surprisingly effective, if you find yourself drifting off in a conversation that's not necessarily that captivating for you, is to start really focusing on the colors in their pupils of the person that you're looking at. One, that's going to keep you present in the conversation because most pupils are really gorgeous things with incredible colors in them. And two, in addition, it gives you that kind of deep, soul-searching eye contact that Clinton was famous for. Obviously, don't overdo it. A little goes a long way. Three, if you really are still having trouble getting interested in the person that you're speaking with, pretend that they're the main hero, the main character of an indie movie, an independent movie. And you know how in some of those indie movies, even the oddest, flattest characters, because they are the hero of the movie, you suddenly really start to root for them? That's what you're doing. So there are three quick things for presence. Power. Single biggest hindrance against power. It's not lack of bank account funds. It's not lack of actual power. It's not lack of powerful clothes. Though all those are, we look for clues to power in the way you dress, the way you speak, what your corner office is like, what your business card is like, fine. But all that is superseded by one thing, your body language. So, if you wouldn't mind, actually, get up. I'm sorry they didn't warn you, this is a physically moving session, yeah. Comfortable clothing and good shoes. All right. So, if you think of a gorilla charging through the jungle, what does a gorilla do if a rival has just breached his territory and he wants to intimidate him off his territory? What does a gorilla do? Yeah, he beats his chest. Why does he beat his chest? What does that do?
Gives him presence.
It gives him presence? Why? What does beating his chest do to his presence?
Takes up more space.
Takes up more space. Perfect. It makes him bigger. It turns out that alpha humans do exactly the same thing. And if you observe alpha humans in an office, they'll use furniture, quote-unquote, wrong. They'll drape their arm on one chair, their foot on another chair, they put their foot on the desk, right? All those are ways of claiming space. If you think of the, you know, nervous, low self-confident person, this is probably going to be a smaller amount of space taken up than your Colin Powell five-star military general. So give me the body language of a general. If you're a five-star general reviewing a little troop of G.I. Joes going in front of you, how would you stand? Straight? Okay. What do you do with your hands?
By my sides.
Actually, you're going to be there. You pound your chest. I don't think generals are going to do that. What do you do with your hands?
Salute.
You're going to be there for a couple of hours while your G.I. Joe troops roll by. What do you do with your hands? Put them on your hips. Yes, you could. That does get tiring. Behind your back. Why do you put your hands behind your back? It puffs your chest out. It makes you look bigger. So put your hands behind your back. Puff up your chest. Actually, you know what? Let's get some stretch. So stretch your hands to the ceiling. Get really tall. And then to the size of the room. We're just trying to make you bigger right now. All right. Now put your hands behind your back. Roll your shoulders. That's great.
Okay, give me the five-star general. The other thing that you're going to do automatically, and a lot of you are doing that already, is, of course, widening your stance. One of the reasons for that is your brain's primary job is to keep you alive. This generally means keeping you upright. Don't waste any of your focus on keeping stable. This means, ladies, I understand that you like having high-heeled shoes. If you can feel perfectly balanced in stilettos, great. If not, it is not worth, at least in critical moments, it's not worth wasting any of your brain's precious, precious focus on worrying about your balance. So, wide stance, big posture, etc. What this is doing physically is that there is a raise in certain studies of about 25% of assertiveness-promoting hormones and a corresponding lowering of anxiety hormones. These are called expansive poses. So see how you feel right now. This is an expansive power pose. You do not need to spend your days like this. It's just giving you a feeling of what this can be. Thank you. So that's on the physical side. On the mental side, what hinders our power? Well, single biggest inhibitor to power is low self-confidence. You can call it low self-confidence, you can call it self-doubt. In one of its manifestations called the imposter syndrome, people feel that they don't really know what they're doing, and it's just a matter of time before they're found out and exposed as a fraud. What's fascinating is that this can actually affect 70 to 80% of the educated population. More fascinating still, the higher up the level of education you go, the worse it hits. Every year, the incoming class of Stanford Business School is asked, how many of you in here feel you are the one mistake the admissions committee made? Every year, two-thirds of the class immediately raise their hand. So there are ways to dismantle the imposter syndrome. We're going to talk about them if we've got time later on. Three-step process, destigmatizing the experience, which is essentially what you're doing just by listening to it right now, lifting the stigma of shame off the experience. Because I have news for you people. Shame is the real killer. Of all the emotions that the human being can feel, shame is one of the worst. It kills us faster than most other things. There is a fantastic TED Talk by Brené Brown on vulnerability, which talks about the effects of shame. Do yourselves a favor and watch it. So destigmatization is step one. Detaching is step two. It's learning how to detach from the thoughts inside your head. Just because a thought is in your head does not mean it has any validity whatsoever. Our thoughts are often completely distorted. Not that long ago, we were convinced the earth was flat. Who knows what we'll discover next? And then rewriting reality. So rewriting reality. Are you familiar with the concept of the placebo effect?
Oh, yeah.
All right. The placebo effect is a fantastic internal mechanism we have and that we seldom use strategically or consciously. Imagine this. It's 8 a.m. Monday morning. You're on the freeway driving to a really important meeting. Fully focused, you're prepared. All of a sudden, a huge black car swerves in front of you, cuts you off, and nearly rams into you and puts everyone else in danger. Would you get at least slightly annoyed? I have a room full of Buddhist monks here. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. So what's happening when you get annoyed? Hormones or chemical substances such as adrenaline, cortisol, stress hormones go flooding through your veins. Who is that hurting?
You.
Let's just get that clear before we move any further. So let's say that you then exit the freeway, and through whatever fluke coincidence, you learn that that idiotic driver of the big, huge black SUV was actually a distraught mother whose baby was choking in the back seat, and it was all she could do to even keep the car on the highway while trying to perform a Heimlich maneuver to save the baby's life. Does that immediately reduce your anger? Yes. In most situations in life, you'll never find out if it was an idiot driver or a distraught mother. As long as it is adaptive for you, you might as well choose the version of reality that suits you best. Again, as long as it is adaptive for you, not necessarily pleasant, I said most adaptive. In this case, baby in the back seat. That immediately takes care of your anger, reduces, you can even go to oxytocin if you want, and we'll learn how to do that, gets you in a much better frame of mind, and you can give your presentation in a much more charismatic manner. All right. So presence, power, and warmth. The inhibitor, so lack of warmth, interestingly enough, can be any of the issues we just talked about. It can be lack of presence. It's hard to be emitting warmth when you're actually not present in the conversation. It can also, and it actually usually is, internal self-criticism. Here's what I mean. Let's imagine that you're in a conversation, and you say something, and you blurt out a sentence, and all of a sudden your brain goes, ooh, that was stupid. What's going to happen to your face?
Blank look,
anguish. Let's get specific. When you say, ooh, that was stupid. Right? You wince, you grimace, you hold tension in your face. So this tension is self-directed. This is self-criticism, self-judgment, self-directed tension, self-coldness, self, etc. Yes? Yeah. But they don't know that. All they know is while they were looking at you, while you were listening to them, looking at them, and possibly thinking about them, they accurately read tension, criticism, coldness in your face. Naturally, what are they going to assume? That it's about them. Think about that. The next time in someone else's face you see tension, criticism, coldness, judgment, etc., there's a fair chance it has nothing to do with you. It is entirely self-directed. So this is another one where rewriting reality can become quite useful. Never assume that your immediate assumption is the valid one. So in order to emanate warmth, there's a quick visualization, the same kind of work that's used in peak performance athletics, that I'm going to run you through. And I'm very excited about this one because I never get to do this one in the corporate world. This is very uncorporate. It's one of the fastest routes to oxytocin, which will get your eyes sparkling, your face all wonderful. So could you please find someone in the room that you do not like? I'm kidding. Find yourselves a partner. Turn towards them. Hopefully someone you don't know yet. So find a stranger and go face them. Get up. Move around, people. All right. Take a good look at each other. Take a good look at each other. Look at their eyes. Look at their eyes. And now, both of you, close your eyes. I want you to think of a problem at work. Something annoying at either work or home. Something irritating. Something that has wasted your time, your effort, and your money. Focus on that. Open your eyes. Look at each other. All right. Close your eyes again. Now see if you can think of one being, whether mythical or actual, whether it be God, Jesus, Buddha, Mother Teresa, or the Dalai Lama, any being that you believe could have great affection for you. See if you can kind of feel their warmth enveloping you. Now think of one being for whom you have great affection. This could be a human being, it could be a pet. Feel your affection and your warmth for them and really try to get into those feelings. Now open your eyes and look at each other. All right, you can sit down. Thank you very much. What are the eyes? How many of you are thinking the windows to the soul? It is absolutely true. The area around the eyes is one of the most mobile of the entire human face. It is thus also the most expressive, which is why poker players tend to wear Sunglasses. When two human beings stare deeply into one another's eyes, what happens?
Connection.
In studies where rows of complete strangers were asked to stare into one another's eyes within but a few minutes, participants reported increased affection and even some passionate feelings for one another. So obviously, you don't want to overdo it, but it can be very useful. With all that said, since we're quite nearly out of time, I did promise to speak about the downsides of charisma. And you can place them broadly in two categories: downsides for the organization, downsides for you. Downsides for the organization, you can pretty much guess what they are. One, charisma gets people to do whatever you want them to do. It's called the metamorphic effect of power. It changes the people that it touches. Abuses of power by charismatic people happen frequently. Two, this is where it gets interesting. It kills brainstorming because people want to believe whatever it is that you're proposing. Three, this is where it gets really interesting. People start seeing you as just superhuman. And two reactions can happen. One, they get overconfident because you know what? Whatever it is, you'll fix it. So they start taking unnecessary risks. Or two, they start underperforming because you know what? Whatever it is, you'll fix it. Those are the risks to the organization. And then there are, of course, all the abuses widely reported. I don't need to go into that. You can look up A in history, and B, interestingly enough, generally it's the dark sides of charisma that are most often studied in leadership handbooks. But what's very seldom talked about is the downsides of charisma for the charismatic person. So, one, I call this a Superman effect. People start to put you on a pedestal, and they start to see you as different from them. It can get lonely to feel that you don't have peers. And a lot of the charismatics, once you start digging under the surface, will tell you that it can feel quite lonely to be as charismatic as they are. Two, like any other messiah, should you fail, you will get crucified. And three, and this is what was for me fascinating, people can share too much. Every form of charisma, there are several, the book talks about them, but every form of charisma comes at a cost. The only difference is what the cost is, depending on which form of charisma you choose to wield. If you, for example, turn on kindness charisma too high for too long, people can hand you their hearts, their souls, their psyche, and you can end up, A, taking them way too close to demons they were not ready to face, or B, they will spill their guts. And the next hour or the next morning, they will wake up and it's kind of a, oh God, what have I done? It's kind of a morning after feeling. And then they recoil, lash out. And who gets punished? You do. So those are just some of the downsides of charisma. You can learn to mitigate them. But what I often say about charisma is that it's a power tool. Use responsibly. With that, thank you very much.
Well, our thanks to Olivia for her comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with a Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Charisma and Leadership. What if charisma could be taught? With Olivia Fox Caban. Now, we open the floor to a Q&A. We have two standing microphones right out there. If you have a question, please stand behind the microphone and speak into the microphone. Any questions? Okay.
Hi. Nice talk. Thank you very much. I was just wondering, because I read some articles about charisma and inverse character-based leadership. So I was curious about your opinion on this. Like, you know, character-based has been like just being yourself. You know, you chew yourself. And then charisma is, you know, all the stuff you said. And all the downside that could bring in to the decision.
So I'm being asked about charismatic leadership versus character-based leadership. So one of my favorite stories, which may be completely fictitious, but it has been repeated enough and it's cute enough that it's worth saying. When Michelangelo was asked how he created his masterpiece, he reportedly said that he did not create the masterpieces. His only skill, he said, was in looking within a block of marble, seeing the statue that was already there, and just removing any excess that was not statue, and revealing the masterpiece within. From my perspective, charisma is not changing who you are. If you try to be inauthentic, here's a good one, actually. Charisma begins in the mind. It is a question of body language, but it begins in the mind. There is far too much body language for you to control consciously. Quick test for you. Were you aware, up until this moment, of your eyelids fluttering in front of your eyes? How about the weight of your tongue in your mouth? What about the position of your toes and your feet? Have you forgotten your eyelids again? There is way too much body language for you to control consciously. If you were to try to fake a specific emotion, it would be tens of thousands of different signals that you need to have in complete congruence, including, for example, the dilatation of your pupils. Good luck with that one. And if even a couple of signals are off, it's going to give on a gut level the feeling of a mixed message to something that's not quite right. One of the specialists in this field told me humans are exquisitely good at detecting incongruence. So if what you're feeling on a gut level is different than what you're trying to portray, even when you control the main expression on your face, sooner or later, what's called a micro-expression will flash. And if those two are different, it's going to be picked up, and you will come across as inauthentic. So trying to fake a charismatic body language is heading straight into a wall. From my perspective, all we're trying to do is give you the tools, not to change who you are, but to get credit for who you are and to make it shine the most. For me, charisma is an asset like any other. It's like learning a new language. That's all it is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question, please. Gentlemen.
He was next, but I'll go.
Please, we should alternate.
Yeah, we should alternate.
How did you get started in this business?
Oh, God. I wasn't expecting that one. Thank you. I was and am a socially awkward, inept introvert. By my late teens, I realized he's going to make me repeat it now. Socially awkward, inept introvert. And by my late teens, I realized I had two options, either exile myself to a desert island or learn how to make this whole human thing work. I have chosen option two for the moment. I'm still keeping the desert island option open. Yes.
I'll second you on that desert island, but I'll probably have to find my own. I actually wanted to ask you something that's becoming a more modern incarnation of charisma that we're hearing about from everything from phone scams to political work, and that is charisma that is expressed without a physical presence, especially in terms of telemarketing. We're hearing stories about con artists and the for-profit colleges and San Francisco newspapers. It's a big question. I was wondering, especially if there are cues that can more easily be picked up for deception when someone is communicating with you on that kind of medium where they are quite deliberately in some cases hiding the direct micro-expression cues.
Thank you. So really, really good question. And I'm going to have a bunch of things for you. Grab a pen and paper. So one, when you're in person, how do you tell if someone's lying? Some of you may be familiar with the show Lie to Me. It's mainly based on Paul Ekman's work. Paul Ekman is the grandmaster of facial expression decryption. His work really is fantastic. He's got an online training program, paulekman.com, paulekman.com. This program is recorded, actually, so you can just listen to it afterwards, where you can train yourself at decrypting microexpressions. And this is the same program that the FBI and the CIA agents use. That's in person. Now, the question that was asked, which is a brilliant one, is, what about charisma online, or at least when there's not a direct one-on-one expression? So Cisco's telepresence apparently is quick enough that it gets you micro-expressions. Nothing else does. So you will be losing that element of detection. That's one element. Two, when there's no physical presence, you can't call it charisma. It's going to be influence. It's going to be persuasion. In that case, what I would recommend is grab a copy of Robert Cialdini's book called Influence and Persuasion. You want the December 2006 edition, which is a white, gray, green. You do not want the all red edition, which is a dumbed-down version for the American mass market. My apologies. Did I answer your question?
Yes, and
the more
you have to say is that is a lot.
Read Cialdini, and that will give you already, here are the main influence tactics that are used. And if you're going to be looking at a distance, you're looking at influence tactics, not charisma tactics. When you're in person, get trained on the Poliquin stuff. That'll give you some micro-expressions. Here's the problem, though. You mentioned con artists. The really good con artists, the best con artists, they're good because in the moment, they are in full congruence. They fully believe what it is that they're saying or doing. And that is impossible to see as wrong because they genuinely and sincerely believe what they're saying. There's not much you'll be able to do against that one.
Hi. I was wondering if there's sort of any difference in the way you teach people across gender lines or racial lines. And I was thinking specifically, like, when you had us doing this sort of stance, I was like, oh, my breasts are being...
Some gestures are gender specific, yes. thank you. Women have a couple of issues more than men will have. For example, the bobblehead. So if you're trying to emanate confidence, you're going to want poise. Again, you don't want to overdo this. Statue still is not where you're heading. But what you don't want is too often with someone who's nervous or maybe a junior employee or someone who really wants to make you see that they're really, really listening and they're really, really attentive to what you're saying. Nodding once is fine. Nodding six times in a row is not. This is something that women tend to do more than men. A, B, pitch. If your pitch is so high that it would take a mouse or a dolphin to hear it, you have a problem. So those are issues that women just by nature I've seen tend to struggle with more than men. Beyond that, most of the power signals and most of the physical power signals you actually can use quite well as a woman. So actually, I didn't even pay attention, but just look at my stance right now. And on stage, you'll see me usually, A, walking the stage beforehand because this is going to be my turf. I need to feel that this floor, my brain needs to be able to completely relax that it has walked every ounce of this floor. And that way it can let go of any anxiety about balance and obstacles and focus completely on the presentation. But you'll see me generally with a fairly wide stance and generally fairly broad shoulders taking up space. It can be done as a woman.
So most of us work in global teams with colleagues from around the world visiting us and us visiting them. Would you have any modifiers to your suggestions for global interaction?
The question was about global interactions, and thank you. Everything I say is North American specific. It's a fast and easy answer. You could, to a certain extent, bring that to the Western societies, but even a lot of what I say in France, for example, would be neither applicable nor appropriate.
Yes. I'd like to have your opinion. You think Al Gore lost the presidential election by lack of charisma? And second, would you be able to pick the presidential winner of this race there by their charisma and their tone of voice and their congruency?
Thank you. So the question here focused on presidential election and presidential candidates. So I was asked to grade Mitt Romney on his charisma a couple of months ago. And purely on charisma, not on politics. Let me get that straight. I essentially had to give Mitt Romney an F in charisma. Purely on charisma. And there were a couple of things. If I remember correctly, the specific clip, it was very specific. It was one clip they were asking me to grade. The specific clip was lacking congruency, lacking warmth. I think it was lacking all three. Yeah. Now, the newscasters may have chosen the clip specifically, but I was decrypting. If you want to look at the converse, go to my blog, askolivia.com, like asking a question, askolivia.com. There's on the blog a analysis of Steve Jobs where I'm taking him apart in charisma from, again, 84 to, I stopped at 2011, and it links to each video. There you see how he gains each element of presence first, then power, then warmth. Yes, ma'am.
My question regarding the comment that you had about the imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
And the inverse of that being, you know, people who believe really strongly about something that they know very little about but believe that they're experts.
Yeah.
But the fact you mentioned something about imposter syndrome and how to interact with that, and I find that a lot in my practice, that as people become more well-versed in their field or in their study, that they become more insecure about it because they appreciate the wide body of knowledge that there is to know, and so they doubt themselves more. But how would you go about trying to interact that natural tendency?
So actually, the question is a perfect answer, so thank you for having answered that one yourself. the question was about how the imposter syndrome actually grows as you learn more. And when the researchers were looking at the fact that the imposter syndrome seems to hit higher, the higher up the level of education you go, this is right now the best speculation we have, is that the more you learn, the more you're aware of the sum total of knowledge there is to know, and the smaller your own seems in comparison. So I can't delve deeper into how you handle that progression. You can handle it. Yes, it's in my book. It'll be in a variety of other sources that you can get. And come speak to me afterwards, actually, and I can point you towards some more resources. Last question.
I noticed that before you began, you seemed to take command of the room. And I wondered if you could say more about how you do that.
Thank you. I'm ending on a compliment. That's lovely. I've just been told that before I started speaking, I took command of the room. How did I do that? A couple of ways. So first, those of you who were early probably saw me walking the stage, right? I was walking every element. I counted the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I know how many steps I have from here to there. I no longer need to look at my feet. I've walked backwards. I've walked forward. This is my turf. It's like a tiger pacing through his territory. I own this stage. 1, 2, sheer physical presence. I'm 5'5", but I walk as if I were 6'7". So you see me walk this stage, look at the space that my shoulders are taking, look at the length of my strides, unusually long strides for a 5'5 woman, right? And I could lengthen them if I had to. Wide stance. But none of this matters. What you saw me do and what caught the room is that, obviously, most of the attention was on me as I was walking up the steps, but I walk to the center. Look at my feet. They're grounding themselves in the floor. And then what do? I pause. It's called a dramatic pause for a reason. It adds drama. The other thing, and this is a great thing to close on, is that if you look at confident people in a conversation, the alpha dog in the conversation is the one who pauses the most confidently. Now look at my speech pattern. What I'm indicating to you is that who I am or what I am saying is so darn important that you will not dare interrupt me. And if you want to get slightly more refined, there are ways in which my voice is telling you whether this is a between the sentence break or a complete end break, and you're allowed to speak. What's the difference? Look at the tone of my voice. When I'm telling you this sentence is not over, my voice is level, it drops, but it has a slight rise at the end. When I'm telling you my sentence is over, and if this were a dialogue, you would be allowed to speak, my voice is level and it drops. So the converse of this is someone who's not sure, whose voice rises at the end in a question. The sky is blue? I'm telling you, the sky is blue. Right? Drop of the voice. If I were to pause in the middle, like the alpha dog I am, my voice would have been level, it would have dropped, and it would have risen slightly. And if you listen to this presentation again, you'll hear me do that again and again and again. That is how I control the room. I hope you enjoyed the experience, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Olivia for her comments here today. We also thank the audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.